Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right. Well, the Manifesto for Repairing Divided Communities That Is Inclusive Transportation is out through Island Press. Its author, Veronica O. Davis, joins me to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure, and I'm really excited to talk to you about this. I think it's a really vital and interesting work, and something that really kind of bridges the border here. It's a problem I see here in Winnipeg, and not just a U.S. thing. This is an outgrowth of your work as a planner, and I'm curious about the point at which you decided the work you were doing wasn't enough, and this book was necessary for the work.
I will say that, you know, from a planner perspective, so I've worked as both a planner and an engineer. And, you know, a short story of my career is that I started the federal government and you want to create change, but you're so far removed from the people. And then I went to go work for an engineering firm. And again, I'm making engineering decisions from the comfort of my desk without ever knowing these communities and saying that, yeah, we're not having an impact. I had a chance to work as an urban planner, and you definitely people at that level. But then when starting my own firm, it was really the realization that we have these technical processes and we have these engagement processes, and they don't always inform each other. And a lot of what my firm's success was building that framework to inform these things. And then you realize I can't be everywhere. So let me write this book so that people have a framework for these types of projects and for younger planners now that are, you know, in school, that they have another resource as they prepare to start their careers.
Is it a resource then that you had wished you'd had when you were in school?
Absolutely. When I remember back in planning school, you know, you read a lot of philosophy books, and I remember we had one book that was around community engagement, but it really was, you interviewed the community, you went and did your project, and you present it back. You didn't learn how to structure a meeting to get what you needed out of the meeting. You didn't learn how to think about a full process. And so it really is missing. And now I have been out of school, admittedly, for, you know, maybe a decade or two, and things may have changed. But I just know that when I was there, I didn't have this type of a resource.
And maybe based on some of the planners you've seen in the interim, that it's still a gap that hasn't been addressed in school. So then as you're, you know, doing your work out in the real world, let's say, were you kind of jotting down like these are gaps, these are things that I see, and then like kind of keeping notes on what you would want to address that formed the kernel of this book? Or like, did you sit down at a certain point and think, what are all the things that I think are missing and how do I go about addressing all of them in this book?
I think like most things, it's an evolution over time. I fortunately, in having my company that I co-owned, you had clients that were willing to try new things. And with that, we were able to try. Sometimes we failed, but then we had our successes. And that's really what formed a toolbox, if you will, of how to do these types of engagements. As an example, I do share in the book, we had a project where it was a bus project. And typically what happens with public transportation projects or any public project, you have a meeting in some stuffy elementary school, you know, auditorium or gym, and you have boards all around, and then you force people to come there right around dinner time. Versus we took the approach where we looked at the data to see where were people getting off the bus, that they may not be going to work, where they're going home, where they may be a little bit more willing to talk. And we actually set up the meeting in the bus stop. So there was no way to miss this meeting. You stepped off the bus right into our meeting. We had very targeted questions that people could answer in 2 to 3 minutes. And we got really great feedback that truly reflected the diversity of the community versus having it in a gym. You get self-selecting people. And so it's just, again, it's a kind of compilation of different projects that I worked on and the things that I learned from them. And I even share in the book a failure where I learned the hard way that DC libraries have police. And I do share that story in the book and everything that went wrong with this project, even though we did very good engagement, but it's the things that we went wrong and what I learned from it going into another similar project.
One of the things that struck me reading the book is, in the same way that we, you know, talk about doctors and having like bedside manner versus, you know, like getting the grades that they need to pass the science portion of tests, it seems like the engineering world maybe has like a similar kind of gap between like social EQ type of stuff versus IQ. Is that something I'm reading into it, or is that something that you see as well?
Oh, there is a major gap. When I was in, so I started off undergrad civil engineering. I learned how to design, and I was given what to design and how to design it. So you sit there and you design. You're not considering the land use. You're not considering the people. You're just doing your design. And that's unfortunately how a lot of engineers are trained. And while, you know, from a bachelor's perspective, you do have to take your humanities classes, most engineers never really learn about people. They are just learning how to do the design. It's about the physics or the, you know, differential equations. So you're so caught up in the data and the numbers that you never learn about the people side of it. I never had a single class where I learned about public engagement from engineering specifically. I never had that. And so that is a major gap. And I know that I sit on the advisory board of Cornell University Civil Engineering Department. And that's the thing that I continue to raise, that we need to have curriculum where engineers can learn how to talk to people and articulate what is happening to people, because it is really a gap.
Yeah, it did strike me that like a sociology course or something around, you know, survey methodology and, you know, how to figure out what you don't know and how to find out those things might be a really valuable skill. Because like you talked about, you know, the example you used where getting people off of the bus stop, like you're capturing the people you need to hear from versus that like group who come to a meeting who, you know, when childcare creates a barrier or when supper time creates a barrier, that you're never going to hear from these people if you design your methodology in a certain way.
I think it's that, but I also can say with engineers, I'm probably more of an outlier in terms of being very outgoing. And I think a lot of that is just genetics. I have a very like super extroverted mother. And so I think some of it is just genetically, I am more outgoing, but a lot of engineers are not outgoing. A lot of engineers don't know how to talk to people. And so I think even, yeah, there's the survey methodology piece, but I think engineers can also benefit from, you know, communications classes where they learn how to speak, where they learn how to present, even complicated things to lay people, where they learn how to write. I was a terrible writer until I went to planning school because I never really, you know, writing for technical is very different. You're just stating the facts. Whereas when you're on the planning side, it's, well, now what does that fact mean? And how does that fact help you move forward? So I think it's even broader than that of really, I think communication is extremely important. And I know for a lot of my engineering mentees, I tell them the best thing they can do from their career is to invest in learning how to write better and be able to really publicly speak and speak to people in a way that's in layman's terms, but that's not condescending.
Well, speaking of that writing aspect, I mean, this book, as you said, like targeted towards future planners, towards people who are, you know, studying in that field right now. But I think it's an eminently readable thing for someone who doesn't have the technical acumen. How much thought did you give to the language you used and how you were going to write these concepts with maybe an audience that wasn't technical in mind?
I was very focused on the audience of my book. So there, part of it was, you know, I was talking to the industry and really, again, the future of the industry. And when you think about the people who are in their undergraduate or graduate careers right now, they're kind of lay people. You know, they may understand a few of the concepts, but it really hasn't been, they're still in the learning process. And so when you target them, you do have to use a different language. But then I'm also targeting advocates in the space, journalists that are in the space and that are talking about it. And so in that case, it is about explaining it a little broader. And I think the one thing I hope I was able to do, and at least I've gotten some feedback from lay people that are like, oh no, now I understand why there's importance to have a lane diet. And so I did my best to try to not make it this book that was just like a slog to read, but to make it a book that was conversational and in a sense, maybe a little bit of lecture, but making it a little bit more conversational to make it accessible to people, even people, public, you know, elected officials, as they're making decisions so that they can understand the world and understand the power that they have as elected officials.
Is that accessibility something that you figure out, you know, with an editor? Like, do you give it to someone who isn't a planner and say, hey, can you read this and get feedback and consider, like, am I getting my message across? Or how do you, like, do you internally kind of edit yourself and figure out whether you're being, you know, conversational in some sense or at least not too clinical?
Well, the writing process involved a lot of different tiers, but essentially, you know, first for me, it was just getting everything out. And I've talked a lot about these topics. So some of it was going back and listening to my own keynotes and workshops that I've done and just translating it. And so if you think about a keynote is going to be more accessible because you are talking. You are just trying to get ideas across to people in a very short amount of time so that they're revved up for the rest of the conference or summit or whatever the convening may be. But I did have three different groups of editors. So my first editor, Courtney Lynx, who I do reference in the book, she was the one that encouraged me to even write the book. She was my content editor, and she doesn't live in this world. So it was nice to work with her, for her to say, okay, hey, can you, this might make sense to you, but can you explain this a little bit? Like, what does this mean? So she's not a technical person. And so she was that first content edit. Then I had a second round of edits where the, you know, making sure it flowed, the consistency. And again, they had an idea of the world just with, you know, by the nature of Island Press, you know, typically having books in this type of a genre, but they weren't experts. And so they were also able to get feedback. So I think, you know, definitely working with those two teams really helped to make it accessible. And then, you know, and having conversations of when it's okay that I don't want to get too deep into this topic. So I will reference other materials if people want to get deeper into the topic so that I can focus on the bigger message.
Right. So keeping kind of that keynote vibe rather than like the presentation at the conference that has like the like slide deck that's 20 pictures long of graphs and things. You don't want to get too bogged down.
Exactly. I've you know, had many books where you're like, oh, the content of this book is really great, but it's taken me forever to get through it. I wanted it to be a book that people could read. And then even structuring it similar to Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And I love that structure of I'm going to present this idea, I'm going to tell a story, and then I'm going to invite you to reflect. And so that's why every chapter ends with a reflection. And it's a, hey, this is my idea. I invite you to see my idea. I am going to tell some stories along the way. Now you sit down, reflect. What do you think about what I said? Where do you see that this is applicable? And that's why every chapter has a moment of reflection.
Right. A chance to engage with it in a different way than just simply reading it.
Exactly.
You write in the introduction, show me a transportation network and I will tell you the values of the decision makers who designed it. I mean, it's an accurate summation of things, but like in your own experience, like that's something that you see when you travel that like you can determine based on the transportation network, what the society values, what that neighborhood or that city or that country value?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look around the United States, you know, we have plenty of little towns, suburban areas, cities where you have very walkable communities, where the streets are narrower, where, you know, a child can safely walk to school. And there's also plenty of places around the country where, you know, it's 10 lane roads and a wide median, and you're asking a child to go across. That to me, it just shows that we are valuing moving cars, people in cars, more than we are valuing moving pedestrians. And even talking of some of my travels, I spent time in Antigua, Guatemala. It is a very, very walkable city. It's probably more inconvenient to have a car because there's no parking anywhere. But it's an older city that keeps the older vibe. And at the time, there were no cars. And so it is a city that you can move around and walk around and navigate easily. And even as I've traveled to other countries where I don't know the language, I talk about Brussels, and Brussels is one of my favorite European cities, but it was for the fact that I could navigate this city without having a car. I felt safe. I could use transit without knowing the language, but I was able to navigate. And so that is shows a value around moving people without them having to be in a motor vehicle. And so that's where it comes down to, you know, show me the network and you can see the value of that particular area. If kids can't walk safely to school, are we valuing kids? As we design schools, you know, now it's these mega schools. And so you have a drop off line 2 miles long versus the town I grew up, which is an older suburb. But I was able to walk to school and, you know, safely even at elementary school.
Yeah. And you write that, you know, like one of the things that should be on the face of it, a pretty apparent thing is like, you know, this child safety versus, you know, being inconvenienced like a couple minutes on your drive. The equation should fall towards the child safety, but that we've shown, or at least, you know, cities have demonstrated time and again that no, that actually is not the side of the equation they take the positive on, that they determine no, it's the saving time and the cars are moving the cars most effectively is the genesis of the decision making.
Absolutely. And so then child safety becomes, I need to lock my poor baby in this big, you know, super suburban vehicle that's like the size of a small bus so that I know that they're safe and they can get to school.
Which they're safe in. But then, of course, if I'm coming up on another child, the front of my hood is too high for me to see that small child.
Absolutely. You can't see, you know, even with my job, we have big work vehicles and I'm like, you can't, it's like driving a bus.
Yeah. And you're right. You know, it's something that I was definitely thinking about around EVs, about technology not being necessarily the thing that'll save us, that, you know, car companies are racing to deliver vehicles that can operate without a driver, but it's still a car, right? That these are, our solutions seem to be oriented around the car rather than, you know, rethinking things to maybe not include the car or to lower the usage of the car.
It's still a car, and it's still a car that can only move a certain number of people. I think one of the things that has been a little disappointing around, you know, the tech and the car and all of that is there has been no focus. There have been some, let me not say no. There have been some, but there's been very little or not enough focus on, you know, shuttles or even, you know, larger buses in order to be able to move people, you know, where you can move a lot of people at one time.
Now, I mean, the timing of this book kind of coincided with COVID and people having to work from home and things like that. And we saw maybe a vision of what things could be without, or, you know, as an adapted or adopted change. And then we've gone back to, no, we're going back to kind of how we used to be. Did that give you pause at all as you were writing this?
Interestingly enough, it didn't. What it is, it's you have an industry. And so it's both the transportation industry and the real estate industry that is fighting to go back to how things used to be. The good old days of 2019, when everyone, you know, drove or commuted downtown to get to their office. I think the challenge is the workforce, and this is why, you know, we are seeing kind of the brain drain, if you will, out of the workforce, is that you had people, and it's not just the young, you know, office workers, you have office workers of all generations who got accustomed to working from home. And they realized, I can work from home, I can be more effective, and I don't have to spend 3 hours of my day in traffic. If I need to get up and just take a break and go walk the dog, I can do that and get right back to my work. and they don't want to come back to work. And I think that you see it where I don't know any downtown in North America that's truly recovered yet in terms of the full workforce going back. And there's all these articles of like why everyone needs to go back to the work, you know, go back to the to an office. And you have a workforce that's saying, no, I'm not going back. And I think that that is something we haven't reconciled with, unfortunately, and something we haven't learned from the COVID experience. And we haven't adapted. And so there are companies that have made the adaptation where maybe it's hybrid or in some cases fully remote. And so they're moving to smaller office spaces. And then you have some companies that are just, you know, fighting tooth and nails to get employees to come back. And the employees are saying, no, I don't want to go back to your office. So I think over the next couple of years, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And not even just the transportation industry, just across all industries of office workers, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens and, you know, who kind of wins the stalemate of remote work.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see in terms of the dynamic about, you know, these, particularly around like city planning aspects of, we've had like burgeoning suburbs. And so then, of course, when, you know, the transportation piece kind of comes in, it's getting everyone like to and from a downtown for a work day. And then if the downtown is vacant because of, you know, people working remotely, what do we do with the downtown? And how do we rethink like the whole city as an entity then at some point?
And I think that there are people who are, you know, there's always the change or be changed. And I think that there are people that are rethinking it. And I know that even in some cities, you do have office buildings that are, you know, they're looking at office to residential conversions or office to hotel conversions. So that is, you know, in the works. And I think some people are realizing, I'm never going to fill this office building. So what else can I do? You also see kind of the advent of, you know, smaller kind of co-working spaces that are becoming more popular where a company can have a small space that allows for a hybrid workforce without having to, you know, have dedicated floors, if you will, of people. So I think the savvy ones are adapting. And I think you have some that are just fighting for the good old times. And so at some point, they're going to be changed.
Well, a book like this definitely helps in terms of, you know, adding to the consideration of what a future looks like and how to shape things differently if we're going to rethink the overall city and how it's distributed and how people get around in it. I'm curious because it's not something that comes up in the book, but the opposition to 15-minute cities that we've seen, to me, it seems like the most obvious thing is like you do want to live within a walkable area of groceries, of, you know, your school or your workplace, that spending all this time in the car to and from different things is a waste of your time. On a transportation level, I have to imagine a concept like a 15-minute city is a ideal thing because it takes a lot of people off of the road.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the, I've heard 15-minute cities presented in different ways. So one, it's, you know, where you can walk in 15 minutes, and some it's, you know, how you can move in any other way. So whether it's by transit, you know, in 15 minutes transit, you might be able to get a little further. Mm-hmm. Even if you drive, you still may be able to get a little further. So I think it just broadens that definition of what that 15 minute begins to look like. I do think there it's something to be said. I think for if we go back to COVID, you know, I was living in DC at the time. And even with, you know, lockdowns, I lived in a neighborhood, I could walk to a grocery store and I could walk to restaurants and Starbucks and all of these things. I could walk, and across the street was a big, massive park where I could meet with friends and be able to socially distance and be outside. So I think there is something to be said about that. But I also think, you know, from a transit perspective, you know, hopefully, helps us to rethink even how we design our transit systems, because almost most cities, you know, you design the transit system to get downtown. So it's, you know, high frequency in the morning, getting downtown, kind of in the middle of the day, high frequency in the evenings, trying to get people out. But with people not coming to work, you're seeing in the data even a shift of people are still using transit. They're just not using it in the same way. And the question is, how will transit begin be able to respond to that? How does transit respond to someone that maybe wants to move from a 15-minute community to another 15-minute community, but there's no connection? When I lived in Washington, D.C., I had a bus that could get me downtown in 20 minutes. It was an express bus that could get me downtown in 20 minutes. But for me to go to my church, which was 2 miles in the same neighborhood, I would have to take either two buses or a bus and a metro, and it would be 40, 50 minutes.
Because that wasn't the purpose of the transit, right? Like they weren't thinking.
Exactly, because the transit wasn't trying to get me to church. Transit was trying to get me downtown.
And that's something that you ask people to think about in the book, right? That like the purposes and the reasons for which people need to get around, it's not all economic based, and we need to consider all of the usages and all the reasons and all the people.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why I opened up the book in chapter one with the transportation story. Because I think what tends to happen for those of us in this profession, we're on autopilot. And we don't think about why we make our own individual decisions. And that's why I invite the reader, like, tell your transportation story. It doesn't have to be anything dramatic. It's just as simple as, why do you move the way you move today? And there are different decisions that people make. Some people may say, I have a long commute because it was important for me to live next door to, you know, my mom, you know, to help out with the grandkids. You know, that is a decision and it's okay, but just helping people understand the different decisions that they make for where they live and how they move so that you can just have that understanding of other people. And then what prevents you from making a different choice for how to move? And it's just say, hey, I would use transit, but I can't get to it. Or I would use transit, but the park and ride, I know it's going to be full by the time I get there. And there's no bus that gets me from my house or near my house to the park and ride. And that helps to just explore those different things. And hopefully, you know, it allows people to bring that into their work as they're just working with different communities.
Well, the book opens with the words, what do we owe each other? In the preface, it's a great question that I believe you go some ways to answering in the book. But there's still a lot of questions that it raises for folks to consider. So I think that like any good book, it kind of lives on after you finish reading it. Inclusive Transportation is out through Island Press. Veronica Davis, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the book.
Thank you.